Testing 1, 2, 3. This is an interview as part of the Oral History Project sponsored by the American Association of Endodontists. The interviewer is Dr. Roger P. Desolet, and the interviewee is Dr. I. B. Bender.
My background is so forth. I want to say I was born in Russia in the year 1905. I came to the United States with my mother and brother when I was 9 and a half, and it was 2 months before the First World War. We came here for two reasons. One was to escape the persecution, the religious persecution of the Tsar. And secondly, my mother was interested to see that we were able to get a college education or a university education, which was difficult for the Jewish people to get in Russia. And so there, by the grace of God, and my mother's far-reaching thinking, I am now in this wonderful land, and also able to give you my experiences in endodontics, which probably if I didn't come here, maybe I'd have been a Russian endodontist. I don't know if I'd be interested in endodontics. But nevertheless, I am here. Time in the United States for our family wasn't easy. I had to work my way through school, and even before school, that is when I was going to primary school, I was selling newspapers, flowers, shining shoes, all sorts of things to help the family economy, because my father was not too good a provider. He was a cantor, and the earning a living under those circumstances was not too good. Anyway, went through school here, went to Central High, and then after Central High School, I enlisted and matriculated to Penn. But before I matriculated at the University of Pennsylvania, I didn't have any money, so I got a job as a surveyor building the Broad Street subway for about a year's time. And then after I got a little money, I was able to pay my tuition. And at that particular time, it was a one-year pre-dent program. And although initially I had decided to go in for medicine, I felt that it would be too expensive and too long, because medicine at that time was 7 or 8 year program, whereas dentistry was 5 year program, and I was the last class to be in the 5 year program, so I only had 1 year of pre-dent.
Ivy, would you, as part of what you're talking about, would you talk to us about some of the other members of your family, specifically like your brother or anybody in medically related?
Yeah. Well, it's, I can go in for that. I matriculated at the University of Pennsylvania and pre-dent. I made that decision. And my brother matriculated as a pre-med. And he graduated University of Pennsylvania Medical School, and then he went on to be an intern at Temple University, and then subsequently he decided to go into neurology, and he went to Mount Sinai, New York, where he remained there for many years, and subsequently became chairman of the Department of Neurology. I continued, of course, as a dentist, and I went to University of Pennsylvania Dental School, and there I was exposed to a number of people who, that is the faculty, that were had some influence on me, particularly Dr. Appleton, who was in the bacteriology department, and Dr. Grossman, who was interested in the, or was in the endodontic department, or at that time there was no endodontic department. It was the Department of Operative Dentistry with a section in endodontics. Dr. Appleton had a rather a constructive influence on me in that his approach was everything on a scientific basis, trying to back up any of the statements that were made with experimental evidence, and this had an important bearing on my practice. As far as the rest of the faculty in the dental school, I felt that they were too rigid. They acted out their aggressions on the students, and when you asked them a question and they didn't know anything, they, of course, they tried to tell you how ignorant you were, most likely covering their own ignorance. Most of the dental training that I received was more mechanistic than biologic, and I felt that upon graduation I felt very inadequate, and I felt that I should have some more training, and I was terribly disappointed in some of the faculty at school. For example, in the Department of Physiology, when I was given an exam, and before the exam I prepared myself with extracurricular reading and reading other texts. And when I took the exam, I felt that I did very well in there, because what I had to say made sense to me. And of course, I was terribly shocked when I found out that I flunked the exam. And then the next exam, I decided I'm going to just give them what they gave me, because the instructor wants to, I guess he wanted me to just give him what he gave me. And so I decided that's what I'm going to do. And sure enough, in the next examination, I got a 95. And I felt that, well, if I want to graduate, I guess I better just follow this kind of a philosophy. And most likely, I'll improve upon it after I get my DDS degree. And which, after upon graduation, I decided that I was going to take an internship at one of the hospitals, which I felt that would probably give me a broader education and more experience. And I took the internship at what was known as the Old Jewish Hospital, which is now the Albert Einstein Medical Center at Broaden and Olney. And there I had a very exciting experience. I met medical people that more or less thought in the same manner as I did. I had a chance to express myself, and there wasn't that rigidity, and I realized my limitations of my knowledge, and so I started to study some of the basic sciences, such as bacteriology and physiology and pathology, and pharmacology, and I attended all the some of the clinical pathologic conferences and some of the post-mortem conferences and so forth. And there I was able to get a entirely different approach to dentistry. I tried to correlate and integrate some of the basic sciences into my thinking, and I developed a concept and philosophy which led me or caused me to do research to disprove some of the concepts and the accepted dicta that was prevalent in those days, particularly focal infection. The focal infection concept was quite in vogue, and most teeth were extracted. Nobody thought in terms of doing any endodontics. And so one of the early experiments that I performed to try to get some evidence against the focal infection theory was to take some fresh blood and mix it with some bacteria, particularly the A. virulent type of bacteria, and I found that the blood was able to destroy the bacteria, manifesting the antibacterial property that the blood had. Now that was the first phase of my work, or sort of getting my feet wet into the experimental evidence. While I was at the hospital, of course, I was able to go into the various departments, and particularly the OR, and that is in the operating room, and there I saw the application of the basic sciences into a clinical application. It opened up my eyes a bit to see how these basic sciences fit into the picture of treatment. I was able to synthesize quite a bit of this information into my thinking, as I mentioned before, and this helped me into developing clinical judgment, and I began to feel as if I was a clinician and not a technician, because at the time when I graduated dental school, I felt that I was a technician, and the old term that many of the medical men used to say is, you're a tooth carpenter, and many times I agreed with them. But of course, with this kind of background and training that I got, I was able to feel in my own way that dentistry too can be placed on a biologic level and get away from some of these mechanistic concepts.
That's better. At that stage, you know, in your life when you're concerned with focal infection, did you have any other real concrete, like, interest in endodontics, or was it just your association with Dr. Grossman at the University
I'm glad that you brought that point out, because what I wanted to say was the reason that I probably drifted towards endodontics was the fact that being exposed to Dr. Appleton in the bacteriology department, of course, at that particular time they were doing culture control in the endodontics, and I felt, well, here at least is one area where medicine is applicable. And so I guess that provoked me into drifting into that particular area. Also, one of the first cases that I reported in the dental literature and the dental cosmos I think back in 1932 or thereabouts, somewhere around that time, was a case of atypical facial neuralgia. This patient came into the dental clinic complaining of pain, and when I examined her, I found nothing of that indicated of dental origin, and I felt that it was probably a medical situation, most likely neurologic in nature. And the patient insisted I extracted the teeth, and I didn't extract the teeth at all. I told her that I wouldn't extract. And then about a couple of months later, she came back to the clinic and telling me that she feels fine since the teeth were extracted. So I said, well, that's good, but I hope it doesn't come back. And sure enough, about 4 months after that, she came back complaining of the same situation and even worse. It turned out that she did have an atypical facial neuralgia, and she was referred to Temple Fay, the neurosurgeon, and he did a carotid denudation because at that particular time, they thought that probably some of the sensory fibers were around the blood vessels, and that it was this was the cause of the arteriosclerosis and so forth was the cause of this pain. It turned out that the interesting feature about that operation was that you had the patient under local anesthesia, and he stimulated with a ferritic current in the area of the common carotid artery, and the patient said that she felt it in the palatal area, she felt it in the nasal pad area, and so forth. And they did a denudation, and then he applied the current, and the patient said she didn't feel it, and so he thought that he was on the right track. Anyway, what happened was that this patient subsequently became psychotic, and she died about a year or two later at Philadelphia General Hospital. So I don't know whether it was of that nature or not, but in the search of the literature, found that these patients that have the atypical facial neuralgias, when you start surgical procedures, they become worse. And this proved it so. One of the reasons why I remember this particular case is that my brother, being a neurologist, I reported, of course, this first case as a neurologic problem, and the first case that he reported when he was at Mount Sinai or one of the other hospitals in New York was a case where the patient had a tooth extracted, and she became psychotic, and she pulled her eye out. So I only thought that the close relationship that I and my brother had, not only from the standpoint of being very close as brothers, but also being close as far as
professions
are concerned, and reporting the same case. I might also add, as long as I'm talking about my brother, that at the year that I was president of the American Association of Endodontists, that same year, he was president of the American Neurologic Association. So both of us were presidents at our respective specialties, which is some factor of coincidence, which is difficult to explain. coming back to my field of interest, namely focal infection, this was at the time when everybody was pro-focal infection, medical men and dental men, and there was wholesale extraction, and there was only one man who really stood up against the entire profession, and he's to be commended, and that was Dr. Lou Grossman, And of course, I was a very strong supporter of this anti-focal infection concept. And so they had, quite a close relationship with him as far as that's concerned. But subsequently, when I began to think in terms of the total concept of endodontics, there were very large disagreements, and I looked upon him as my mentor, but I felt also he was my tormentor in that he probably provoked me into trying to prove my points of view. And at the same time, it was difficult for me to make my stand against his concepts because of my regard for him, and I certainly didn't want to hurt his feelings. It was those days were trying days for me because nobody paid any attention to what I had to say. After all, I was a young snot-nose, so to speak, and who am I to challenge the great authorities? And in those days, of course, especially in the dental schools, it wasn't any of the statements or any of the concepts that were made and were not made on the basis of experimental evidence. It was just based on the fact that they are authorities because they are chairman of the department or they're professors in this department or in that department, and they wrapped themselves around with a cloak of academia, and that was enough for everybody else to accept. Whether it was true or not, the profession didn't seem to care very much. Everything was pigeonholed. He says to do it so and so, he's the authority, we'll follow him. And so this has been the problem with dentistry, and in some areas even to this day, one doesn't challenge or examine what is being said.
Would you care to get into any of the, the treatment modalities?
I'll get into that later. Then the next area that I thought that bothered me most of all as far as endodontics was concerned was the mechanistic approach. And no biologic considerations were ever given. They used sulfuric acid and the sodium potassium alloy, and they would introduce it into the it was a necrotic pulp. They would take a small amount of sodium or potassium alloy on a sort of like a creamy paste, and you would put that into the root canal, and that would explode the organic material, supposedly pulling everything out of the lateral canals and eliminating in that fashion, which to me was a bunch of poppycock. The only thing that I could see there was the explosion. And sometimes it would explode in the patient's face or something like that, even though they did have the rubber dam. And they used all sorts of caustics, germicides, to eliminate the infection. And everything was on an infectious basis, no matter what it was. It was infection. If any complication arose, any swelling or any pain or something like that, it was bacteria. And it's still, even to this day, everybody thinks in terms of that the pain or the complications that arise are of bacterial nature. They fail to realize that much of this complication is a result of chemical irritation. Matter of fact, the tissue does not know how to distinguish irritations, whether the irritation is of a bacterial nature, mechanical nature, or a chemical nature. The reaction is the same. The inflammatory reaction is the same. It's not only of a bacterial nature. And everything was filled. You had to fill it to the apex or over the apex, a sort of complete seal. Everything was mechanical. No consideration was given what had happened to the periapical tissues. And so that much of this philosophy that we had, as I said before, was a matter of you must do A plus B plus C, and therefore you get 100% success. And if you got any kind of a problem, or any kind of a complication, or any kind of a so-called failure, the failure was due to the fact that you missed out on A, you missed out on B, or you had a positive culture, and so forth. And of course, the culture procedure to me was very questionable, because I remember one time, one of the great advantages that I had, again, I go back to my hospital internship days, I was able to discuss many of these things with my medical friends and medical interns and residents, and I was discussing with them the fact that when we do endodontics, we make sure that we eliminate the bacteria because we take a culture. And one of the things that remained in my mind for a long period of time was, he said, well, you take a culture today and the patient comes in the following week and the culture is negative this week, it may not be negative at the time when he comes in. How do you know? And this sort of startled me. Maybe he's got a point. And of course, this set off the investigation as far as determining the value of what the culture would be. That's one aspect. The other aspect was I was a worshiper of the culture concept, the culture idea, two successive negative cultures in my office. And I had my own incubator and I always followed to see that everything was okay. And lo and behold, I had a string of negative cultures, and I thought, oh boy, my technique is terrific. And so one time I checked my incubator, and I found the goddamn incubator was out of order completely. And so under those circumstances, evidently I was filling teeth with positive cultures. Now, and I didn't have any problems or any trouble, because at that particular time, the idea was that if you didn't eliminate the bacteria, your face would blow up, or complications would set in, or you would get subacute bacterial endocarditis, you would get kidney disease, you would get fallen arches and fallen hair and all that sort of stuff. And so this sort of irritated me a bit, and I decided, well, let's look into this business of the culture. And of course, I kept delaying it. I was busy with practice and so forth. And I was also interested in the problem of the relationship of bacterial infections to subacute bacterial endocarditis. One of the men, Dr. Pressman, who was then a resident in medicine, he was interested in subacute bacterial endocarditis, and he asked me to join him in making a study of the relationship between dental infections and subacute bacterial endocarditis. And that's when we started to do the bacteremia studies. And we found that, for example, if we extracted the teeth and we took cultures immediately, we found that the bacteria, we had positive blood cultures in about 85% of the time, taking a sample of 16 ml of blood, which of course would be 100% if you took a larger sample of blood. And so we also found out that within 10 minutes the positive blood culture would drop down to from 85% down to about 40%, and then in 20 minutes completely negative, which supported my initial finding that blood is antibacterial in action. That is, the bacteria, as they circulate through the bloodstream, go through the reticular endothelial system, and the reticular endothelial system destroys most of the bacteria, so that under normal circumstances, a patient with no known disease processes, such as, for instance, a history of rheumatic heart disease, those patients would not develop subacute bacterial endocarditis. The only way that they could develop subacute bacterial endocarditis is if the patient had an organic lesion to begin with. Then the bacteria would alight themselves on the diseased heart leaflets. A blood clot would form around there and would protect the bacteria just like a cocoon. And then subsequently, 6 months later, 6 weeks later, a year later, the patient can develop subacute bacterial endocarditis. I then expanded the study of the bacteremias following certain procedures, such as periodontal treatment, and I found that there was a relationship between the degree of trauma and the incidence of bacteremia. The greater the trauma, the greater was the incidence of bacteremia, and this also correlated very well with exodontic manipulations wherever there was a greater incidence of trauma, we had a higher incidence of bacteremia. And then, of course, the next thing for me to do was to test out, what about how do endodontic procedures stand up as far as bacteremias are concerned? After all, the focal infection, the bacteria are present in the root canal, and the patient can get this and that, and eye trouble, kidney trouble, all sorts of troubles. How would that stand up? And